Accession number 15560, Reel 3.
Mr. Bridge, Reel 3.
I was saying about the relationship between warrant officers and RNVR officers and how you can understand why they didn't always show the respect which the rank demanded. And this was reflected in the attitude of the warrant officer who was working for me, because a warrant officer should call a lieutenant sir, which he never did. All right, I accepted this. I was made aware of this in Plymouth, and I accepted it in Plymouth. But I never lost my own professional standing, and I never remonstrated with them. It is, however, interesting that at the end of 3 days, all the men were calling me sir. Petty officers, warrant officers, the lot and a lot. Now this, in my opinion, is the real way to run a group of fellows. You lead from the front and you command their respect in such a way that they have no alternative but to say sir. And this pleased me no end.
When you were down there doing the job,
yes.
What was your main problem?
Convincing the captain that I wasn't taking unnecessary risks.
Were you taking unnecessary risks?
Not in my opinion. Not in my... according to my experience, I was not taking unnecessary... I was taking risks, which I had to do the job, but I was not taking one... silly risk. I was not taking one unnecessary risk.
Were there any surprises for you technically in those devices in the bottom of the harbour?
Well, I only... The first one was stripped. Take that back a bit. Let me go back a bit in the story. These mechanisms consisted of three depth charges plus an unknown metal lashed together with steel wire. And the previous party had attempted to lift the whole group together and lift them onto the deck, and as they had caught on the side, on the wall, and hit something, there was a shake, and this had caused the whole lot to blow up. And that's how they were killed. Now, when I went down, I told the captain that these things were lashed together with this steel wire, and there were two ways of separating them, because I wanted them separated. And what are the two ways? I could go down there and cut through the wire with a hacksaw, which would not give them a bad jolt. On the other hand, they might slip one against another. The alternative to that was to go down with a 1 ounce explosive charge and shatter the wire with a small charge. I said, in that case, you see, I'll be on the deck. He said, you're doing it by explosives. As quick as that. We're not taking that risk. You're not going to risk your life down there with a hacksaw for half an hour. So we blew it up. It was shattered the wire with a small explosive charge. And in doing so, when I went down again, I found that the depth charges had been laid out in beautiful condition. And the three depth charges were separated and the other mechanism. So it then became clear what the other mechanism was. And it was a thing of two cylinders, a small cylinder being about 10 to 12 inches by about 5 inches, then separated from the lower one, which was about 14 inches by 4 inches, and there was a cable between the two. Well, you could start making guesses at that stage as to what that was, and that was a thing which you'd got to recover, because that's just what killed the previous party. So the first thing to do was to get these things onto the surface, and so I had a small crane rigged up, shear legs rigged up. Instead of the normal three shear legs, as they do usually, we had four for added stability and strength. And went over the pulley, we put four steel horses with hooks on, and I went down, attached these four to the three depth charges and the mechanism, and then we hauled them to the surface one at a time. And this is where you get the volunteers coming in. You see, you know this is dangerous, and you call for a volunteer. And you don't get one volunteer, you get three. And so you pick the chap who's there first to do the dangerous job for you. And the really dangerous piece was stripping or rendering harmless this unknown mechanism. Well, the guess was, of course, the top is the firing mechanism and the bottom is a countermining charge. And the cable does the firing, carries the current for the firing. So, all right, what do you do? It's a moderately long cable. You can pull it to the side of the top charge, pull it to one side. Now, carefully remove the outside covering, and then that revealed wires inside there. This is what the ratings are doing for me. Carefully, you got certainly two, if not three, wires inside there. And then you cut one wire, and then you stagger it, and you cut the next wire, and you stagger it, and cut the third wire. You do not cut straight through. That would be a stupid thing to do. So you stagger the cutting, and once you've cut it, you say, well, it can't fire, it can't go off. So you feel quite confident at that stage. And in this way, we rendered safe both sets of mechanisms and removed the depth charges. Now, I'm sorry, I've forgotten what your question was.
Well, it was basically if there were any technical surprises.
Well, right. Well, first of all, that was a brand new mechanism. It had never been retrieved before, so that was a surprise. The second thing was, what is it? Well, we opened it up, and we thought it was a clock. We thought it was a clock. And I found out that at Milazzo, which is about 50 miles from Messina, there were RAF technicians who were likely to be able to identify this. So I got one of the original VWs, Volkswagens, which had been captured, and I took myself off to Milazzo and left it with the RAF, who said, after some days, it is a 52-day clock. A 52-day. It has a maximum setting of 52 days. Now, that was something in itself, but it also explained something which had not had an explanation previously, and that was, how came it about that in some of the ports captured on the North African coast, Philippeville, Bourne, and places like that, explosions had occurred 2, 3, and 4 weeks after the Germans had left, and no explanation had been found. Of course, this one explained it, didn't they? They had been using this mechanism before.
Any other memories from Messina Harbour?
Yes. My opposite number in the army had a tremendous task dealing with unexploded American and British bombs. The Americans bombed Messina extensively, and they left behind a large number of UXBs. And my opposite number didn't have a suitable method of disposing of these bombs. And he came to ask me, could I help him? And I said, I could. And now I come to the point which I made much earlier on in this talk about methods of disposing of unexploded bombs. You blow them up, you burn them out, or you dump them in deep water. Well, we had the deep water available, the Straits of Messina. It's very deep. So I got an LCM, a landing craft motor, and he brought the bombs down to the water's edge at Messina Harbour, and I loaded up, and I dumped maybe 250 bombs for him in the Straits of Messina. And no doubt they're there today. It is deep water, and if ever they go off, which is most unlikely, they'll cause no damage to anything that is passing over.
And I think you got a decoration for your work at Messina as well.
Oh, I got a George Cross for that. And two of the men got George medals, and one, and the warrant officer got accommodation.
After Messina, what did you do then, please?
After Messina, the next thing that happened to me was that I got my draft sheet home and went to Augusta to board a troop ship bringing home a lot of soldiers. And about an hour before I was due to go on board, the transfer was cancelled and I was told that I was going to Maddalena. So I went back to Messina to find out details of what the transfer was all about and learned that I'd have to go to Palermo because the only way to get to Maddalena was by ship. And I had to live with the Americans for about 3 weeks in Palermo waiting for a boat to take me to Maddalena. That was an interesting experience. They had a different standard of food altogether. And I first had peanut butter and things like that with living with them, and I also had we had hardtack, bear rations, but for breakfast they would have porridge with cream, which we never saw. They also had bacon, egg, waffles and syrup on one plate.
Where's Maddalena?
Maddalena is a small Italian island between... it's not too far from Sardinia. It's a small island, but it was an important Italian naval base at that time. I didn't spend long in Maddalena. There was nothing to do. Possibly the most interesting little piece was walking on a causeway from Maddalena to Caprera, where Garibaldi is buried. But from there, from Maddalena, I went up by MTB to Bastia in Corsica, and there was more work to do.
With what?
A limited number of mines washed ashore. Some Italian mines and some German mines. Not a tremendous number. I'm not sure. I dealt with about 5 altogether. And then in due course I got my draft sheet home from Bastia and reported to Liverpool, and then, you know, you have leave and all the rest of it, and then finally you find out what's going to happen to you after that.
Did you take part in D-Day landings?
Yeah, I did. D plus one, in fact. After returning to UK, I had a fair amount of home leave. I went through a refresher course at HMS Volcano, which was the Naval Bomb Disposal School in Cumbria. And then I was allocated to RN Party 1500, which was based in the London area, and in due course we embarked on the city of Canterbury, waiting for D-Day, which was, as you remember, was postponed a day, and I landed near Arromanches from a small LCM, not quite waist deep, thigh deep, in the water, and we walked to Arromanches on D plus one. It so happened that in our small party was a Royal Marine officer who in peacetime had been a gentleman's gentleman, and he recalled that they had spent a holiday in Arromanches some years previously. And he said, so far as I recall, there's a small hotel here called the Oasis. I wonder if it still exists. So he went along and found it still existed, and that became our base. So instead of sleeping rough, we had a hotel accommodation. Incredible. On D plus one.
Were you part of a unit then?
Yes, we were part of this Royal Naval Party 1500. That didn't last too long because it became headquarters and we had to move out into humbler accommodation.
What was the role of Royal Naval Party 1500 in Normandy?
In Arromanches, there's more than one. They're along the coast at different ports. It was to get the ports operational again. And, of course, at Arromanches, there wasn't a port there. They built the Mulberry Harbour there. So my job was to make sure the beaches were clear of unexploded missiles, this is bombs, shells and so forth, mines, and to a limited extent, Arromanches itself, so that you could move about Arromanches safely. And this meant dealing with unexploded bombs and mines on the beach, telemines and Holtz mines, and any unexploded shells that were lying about, and altogether making the place safe to move about.
Was it a big job?
It was fairly big for 2 or 3 weeks, and after that you'd got the job under control, and there wasn't really much more to do. But I think I did altogether about 6 weeks in Arromanches, and then I came back to UK and was immediately given another RN Party 1501.
Just before we go on to 1501,
yes.
At Arromanches,
yes.
Were there any different kinds of weaponry which you hadn't dealt with before?
Yes, I had not previously dealt with telemines, which are, teller is the German word for plate, which are anti-tank mines, they'll smash a tank track, and Holtz mines, which are small wooden mines, which will blow your foot off. And I hadn't I knew about these two, but I hadn't come across them. But at Arromanches, I had to deal with both kinds.
What were the special techniques of dealing with teller and Holtz mines?
Well, teller mines, you've seen these chaps searching the beach and other places with these metal detectors. We had metal detectors to pick up teller mines, and I didn't have a large number to deal with because that's mainly an army responsibility. But Holtz mines are made of wood, as the name implies, and the metal detector doesn't pick them up very easily. And so you've got to look out very carefully at the configuration of the soil. And on one occasion, I was leading my squad down to the beach when I suddenly discovered we were in a field of Holtz mines. And it was a case of halt, about turn, and put your feet in exactly the same position as you did coming in, and we'll walk out. And we did. We walked out of that field of Holtz mines. It wasn't necessary for us to sweep it, but we just found ourselves in it. But there were times when we found Holtz mines on the surface, which we just simply blew up. They weren't very big. They only had about an ounce charge in them.
What damage could that do?
Well, take your foot off.
Were there any accidents at the Arromanches beaches?
So far as I am concerned, no. Other people may have had them, but I didn't. The only accident I had, and one and only in 5.5 years, was through my leg and arm. And that was the only accident sustained by any member of my squads in the whole of 5.5 years, believe it or not.
That accident you was at Plymouth?
Yeah. Mm.
Any other memories from Arromanches?
Oh, I went to Caen and saw the tapestry.
Oh,
Bayeux. Went to Bayeux and saw the tapestry. No.
Sorry, I interrupted you with you being with your going to 1501.
Yes, 1501. In due course, 1501, we embarked, I think, from Portsmouth, and we went to Courseuil, and we were destined for Le Havre, and went to just outside Le Havre because it was still in German hands. And we were waiting for Le Havre to fall and then move in and start port clearance work. However, whilst we'd been waiting there, another party came along and said, we're taking over from you and you're moving on to Antwerp. So we packed up our gear and went on to Brussels and stayed the night in Brussels because the Germans were still in Antwerp. And next day we cautiously moved up the road from Brussels to Antwerp. And I remember we were in the dock area and we were greeted with machine gun fire from the other side of the Scheldt. So we quickly beat a retreat into the town, and then we started to get our bearings from the safety of the centre of the city. And the naval party was based on the Hotel de Londres, and that's where I lived whilst I was in Antwerp, Hotel de Londres.
What was the main character of the work in Antwerp?
Well, there were no bombs per se. There were no... well, there were mines, and the locals were most anxious to get the port of Antwerp working again, and so were we. And they were pretty sure there were mines in the Scheldt, and they didn't know what kind they were, so they organised what was known as an A-sweep, which means two boats with a line between the two of them going along to see if they can locate moored mines. That had a tragic result. I've forgotten how many men were in the boat, but everyone was killed. And it was half understood that I was going to be on that boat, but somehow I didn't go. I had something else to do. So they had, that was a fatal mistake, and that told me that these are not moored mines, they're ground mines, and if they're ground mines, they're either magnetic or acoustic. And it was pretty certain there were also mines in the docks themselves. Now, it so happens that there was a port minesweeping officer, and I won't mention his name, but he was a 2.5 ringer and I was a 2 ringer, and in due course they sent along what were known as portable pulses, which are something like a big trailer with lots of batteries and cables on it. And he said to me, "These are for sweeping magnetic mines." And I just said, "Oh yes." He said, "I haven't a clue how they work. Would you know?" So I said, "Well, I happen to be a physicist, so I can make a guess as to how they might work, and knowing how the Navy operate, I'd make a guess in a particular way." He said, "Will you try it? Will you operate it?" I said, "Yes." So I took the portable pulser to one of these basins and laid out the cable in what I thought would be the Navy style for that kind of thing, because there was no book of instructions with it. And luckily, on the first press of the button, I got a mine. It just simply blew up. And in the next 2 days, I think I got 2 more mines. I got 3. Well, as soon as that had happened, they said, "Oh, we must have more portable pulses." And, of course... having got that system working, and the port minesweeping officer having the responsibility, it was his job to take over. It was his job to have started in the first place, but he didn't know how, and luckily I found out. So it went on from there. And I didn't have anything more to do with that.
Any more memories from Antwerp?
Yes. The hospitality of the locals was tremendous, and they couldn't do enough for us. And but that was a social life which I'll never forget. I remember their names to this day. The Kleissens, the Hessels and the Swerden Wrens. These are the people who really looked after us and laid out the red carpet. The bottles of champagne we got through in a day was just nobody's business. But the other main memory from Antwerp concerns an instruction I got late one night to tell me that next morning I had to fly up to Nijmegen and to take with me a minimum of bomb disposal equipment. Well, whatever in the world is that? What's a minimum of bomb disposal equipment? You had to make a guess as to what tools you could carry on an aircraft. And I had to report to Brussels by about 8 o'clock in the morning. And then there was this Anson to fly me from Brussels to Grave in Holland. And we flew up this corridor. I don't know how many miles it is, maybe 100 or less. And we never reached treetop height. This was the corridor used in Operation Market Garden. We never reached treetop height, and there were church spires higher than us. There were trees higher than us. There was cows scattering all over the place. These people looking up at this massive aircraft so low. And it was only later I learned that most of the smaller aircraft that had previously attempted to fly up that corridor had been shot down because the Germans were close by on each side. However, we got to Grave, and I got out, and Brian Horrocks, Brigadier Horrocks, had sent his staff car to the plane to pick me up and then took me to his headquarters. In the meantime, he told that plane to get out of it. You're not having a plane as big as that, so near the front line. Get to Eindhoven as fast as you can. So the plane flew to Eindhoven and waited for me there. And I'll never forget being introduced to Brian Horrocks. His headquarters was a tent under a tree. And I said, my name's Lieutenant Bridge. And his first question to me, I remember clearly. He said, "Have you had breakfast?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I have, thank you." And I thought, this is the mark of a big man. You can move your tank corps, 80 miles in one day, and yet you're concerned about my well-being as a man. And I thought, this is one of the qualities of leadership. And it's something which I tried to emulate in later life, but I was never equal to that standard. And at Nijmegen, I don't know if you know about the attack, but after Operation Market Garden had failed, Arnhem, the Germans put 12 very powerful swimmers into the river with three sets of charges to be floated down to Nijmegen, two to attack the road bridge and one to attack the railway bridge. Well, miraculously, they got through to the railway bridge through the defences and sank their charges in deep water. They went off, took out the support to the railway bridge, and the railway bridge dropped into the river. At the road bridge, they were unlucky in that the support was in shallow water. There was a sloping support to the foot of, at the foot of the bridge, so they couldn't get their charges in deep water. And they did the best they could. They got them close to the bridge support. Two charges went off, and with being in shallow water, the main force went straight up and through the road and blew a hole in the road. The other two charges did not go off, and it was my job to try and take out these other two charges and render them safe. Well, I got out one charge and rendered it safe.